Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, your host here on Heritage Radio Network. And today, A Taste of the Past is being brought to you by 360 Cookware. 360 Cookware is top-of-the-line stainless steel cookware that's made in America in the greenest cookware manufacturing facility in the country. It can be used to make all your favorite recipes, but it also gives you the option to cook using vapor technology, which creates a seal that surrounds food with intense heat, locking in vitamins, moisture, and flavor without added fat or oil or excess water. Visit the website at 360cookware.com for more information. You know, Heritage Radio Network does have a few very generous sponsors, and we're always very thankful for that. But when you log in, you may have noticed a new addition to the home page of the website, and that is a donor page. We, like public radio, we do rely also on donations and sponsorship from you, our listeners, and every sponsorship is greatly appreciated. There's a donate button on that page, and you can designate your gift to go to a particular show or for the support of the radio network in general. And any amount of gift helps, especially in these harder times and harder getting sponsors. We appreciate all of your help. Today I want to give a special shout out to a listener and friend, Betty Heilman, and I want to talk a little bit, for those of you who are listening in real time, which today is December 2nd, 2010, you know that we've just finished the Thanksgiving season. Some of you may be listening a month from that date, who knows, but just to let you know that we've just finished the Thanksgiving holiday, and so that means we're in the full swing of holiday season here. And I just have to make a mention of my Thanksgiving holiday. It was really quite interesting because, yes, we had the American turkey, fresh killed, and it was delicious and wonderful. Also, a little invention by my son and his girlfriend called, you know, you've heard of turducken, right? Well, they invented something called the squadoose, which was a goose stuffed with a squab and a duck, all stuffed into a goose. It was incredible. It was fun, all sous vide first and then roasted afterwards. But we also had some interesting additions. We had people from Texas, so of course we had the marshmallows on the sweet potatoes, and we had Indiana stuffing and Oregon Brussels sprouts. And we had a wonderful addition to our appetizers, and that was an Indian dish called khandvi. Judy Reddy and her husband Krishna came to join our table, and Judy made this wonderful dish of rolled chickpea pasta with spicy oils and cilantro and peppers, and something I think is going to be now a traditional part of my Thanksgiving. Which brings me to how traditions develop and how we adopt different foods for different holidays. Last night marked the beginning of the Jewish celebration Hanukkah. And today I'm very happy to have with me Gil Marks. Welcome, Gil.
Thank you very much. Really good to be here.
And today, of course, is the second night of Hanukkah. And Gil is an author, a rabbi, a historian, a chef, a social worker, the list goes on. And he's become somewhat of an authority on culinary subjects in general, and especially Jewish cuisine. Many of you may remember a very special book he wrote called Olive Trees and Honey, about vegetarian cooking in Jewish communities around the world. His newest book is called The Encyclopedia of Jewish Food, just released by Wiley Press. And it is a comprehensive, it's an A to Z guide to Jewish foods, recipes, and culinary traditions. And as he says, don't let the word encyclopedia scare you off. It is an incredible read. It has entries from 1200 B.C., on through the present date. It is giving a timeline of a lot of the foods, and it really is very informative. And, I mean, Gil has written articles for many magazines and done appearances at many food venues around the country. And I like, too, which is evident in this book, I like that he never loses his sense of humor in his writing and his presentations. To give you an example, He presents lectures, and some of the lectures have wonderful titles. Bagels, From Schmear to Eternity. A History of Kolent. Is Kishka named after the wrapper, or is the wrapper named after the stuffing? I love that. And you can hear that, Gil, in the book. It's an encyclopedia, yes. And it does, the layout is like an encyclopedia. You can read it like an encyclopedia. But once you start to get into the history, people will be lost in as I said, the timeline and learning and surprising themselves about things they thought they knew which weren't true.
Right. Well, the basic thing is that most of the things we think about food are not true. And they're what called, in Yiddish, the word is Bubba Mises, which is literally grandma's, which related to babka, grandma's tales, but old wives' tales. Is basically what it is. And one of the fun things for me was to actually research things out and find the truth about things, that matzah was originally soft, that the original latke, since it's Hanukkah, was a cheese latke.
Well, let's don't go there so fast, because that's what I want to get into. Being Hanukkah, of course, we think about the foods that are associated with Hanukkah, and of course, you can't have Hanukkah without latkes, right?
Right.
So that's where I wanted to talk about Hanukkah. Tell us a little bit about first where Hanukkah got its name, and then the celebration, and tell us about the history of latkes.
Okay. Hanukkah is the Hebrew word, means dedication. And what happened was, it's based upon a historical event, which is the first known war for religious freedom. And the Seleucid Syrian Greeks were controlling the land of Israel. And on the Saturnalia, which is the winter solstice, the 25th, which is why Hanukkah begins on the 25th of the month of the Hebrew month. Just the 25th it's not a coincidence that it pops up consistently. And actually, an interesting side point is that even before this story, it was probably a minor little day anyway, because it was the last day, traditionally last day of the olive oil pressing season. And Jews from around the area would bring up olive oil to the temple as some of the first fruits there, and so they probably would have a party anyway. But what happened was, in 168 BCE, the Seleucid under the king Antiochus, they decided on that day to desecrate the temple, and that provoked, amongst other acts, a civil war in which the Jews revolted, and they're under the leadership of the Maccabees, or the Hashmoneum, as they're known, and they 3 years later had chased the Seleucids out of the country and were able to come into the temple to rededicate it, hence the name. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look in the ancient sources, the Book of the Maccabees, there's no mention of what later became the oil situation. And because and I'll explain this, is because after they chased out the Seleucids, they kind of seized power and became a corrupt, despotic group. They really were not nice. And their machinations with each other in 63 BCE led to Rome coming into the country, which was disastrous, because that, of course, led to several revolts and the diaspora, and just the death of millions of people, such destruction. And so the rabbis and the people really did not like the Hashmoneim and things. So whereas the holiday of Purim has a entire tractate, entire book of the Talmud dedicated to it,
Hanukkah does very little mention.
Is included in the tractate of Sabbath, because it's talking about the Sabbath candles, and after the Sabbath candles, all of a sudden it has 1.5 pages, that's all, to Hanukkah. And all of a sudden, for the first time, there's this story appears that when the Maccabees retook the temple, they wanted to light the candelabra, which is known as the menorah. And but this was lit every evening and ran through the night, the same amount of oil each time, but enough to run through the longest night, which I figured was for 8 days would be about three
about
cups
three
of
cups.
Oil.
That's what I had read, too, three cups
and,
of oil.
But anyway, so they were not, they only found one very small vial of olive oil that was pure, and which they would only last, they thought, for a couple of days, but it actually lasted 8 days. And so because...
Hence the miracle of the lights,
yes.
Right, in the oil.
So, but probably from the Book of the Maccabees, actually, the it was probably the 8 days was probably based upon the earlier holiday of Sukkot, which went, mm-hmm. which means it runs for 8 days. And since they weren't able to celebrate it that year, they kind of did a pseudo celebration after beginning on the 25th after they retook the temple. And but basically Hanukkah until the 20th century America was a very, very minor holiday.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, all you did was at evening you lit your candelabra and you went on with your life.
And ate some latkes.
Not even.
So tell me when did latkes come into the picture?
That's the thing. There weren't even the first mention of any traditional food for Hanukkah only comes in the 14th century.
Mm.
Which is, you know, 1,500 years after the event, so that's quite a time span. And all of a sudden, you have two traditional food items emerge, one of which is the obvious one, is fried foods, reflecting the miracle of the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is a little bit more obscure, and it's dairy products, but in particular, cheese. Now, the reason for this is one of the books of the Apocrypha, meaning those books, those ancient Hebrew books that were not canonized and made part of the Bible, mm-hmm. so the non-biblical ancient books, was a book called Judith. It wasn't accepted. So it kind of, the actual book itself disappeared. Today there are four extant versions of it, none of which are in the original Hebrew. And so we're not totally sure which one it is.
But the story
But
nice,
the story anyway. Survived somehow. And during the medieval period, the Jews who did not have a copy of the actual text changed it. So the actual story itself is a Babylonian time period, meaning around the year 580 or something mm-hmm. like that. So about 400 centuries before the Hanukkah story. And then what happens is this one town outside of Jerusalem in the Judean hills is being besieged by the Babylonian army. And this comely young lady in town by the name of Judith devises a plan, basically based, if you know the Book of Deborah in the Bible, there's an instance where the Emperor Sisera, the Syrian Emperor Sisera, escapes the battle that he's losing, runs away, comes to this tent of a woman by the name of Yael, who feeds him dairy products and makes him thirsty, and then when he gets tired, she kills him. So in this story of Judith, she goes there and feeds the general, the Babylonian general, salty cheeses. And when he gets thirsty, she gives him wine. And when he gets tipsy, she cuts his head off.
Right. We see that in art all the time.
Yes,
right?
it's
images
sort of, like,
of Judith holding.
Yeah, that in the
mid,
oh, quite so. Right. Yeah, the Renaissance paintings have that a lot. They really love that story. And anyway, so in honor of the cheese, that dairy products and cheese in particular became a traditional food. Again, in the first mention in the 14th and 15th century, it becoming adapted. And all of a sudden, the other thing to mention is that the Jewish role in cuisine has never actually really been innovation. And occasionally they do. I just saw recently the guy who invented cheese doodles was a Sephardic Jew from Brooklyn. So technically cheese doodle is a Jewish food, even though it didn't make the encyclopedia. What happened was that during the medieval period, new foods and techniques would arrive from the Muslim world,
mm-hmm.
usually first into Italy. So you'd have something like dumplings showing up around the 11th century or 1100s or so. Wasn't known before. Pasta, even though Italians claimed Etruscans made
right.
it, there's really no record of pasta until Actually, before Marco Polo, actually, about 50 years before he was born, we have the first mentions of pasta in Italy. And usually what would happen is about 50 years after these foods would show up in non-Jewish Italian sources, they would show up in Jewish Italian sources. And then about 50 to 100 years after that, they would show up in German Jewish sources.
Guess who laid claim?
Often it was the Jews that transmitted them because right. They were the ones, either through trade or in marriage between communities or the constant interaction between these communities, these dishes would come from one Jewish community to the next. And that role repeats itself over and over again. The Jews will come into community. They'll adapt local foods to the dietary laws, to their taste, share their own dishes. And then when they would go to a new area, they would repeat this, and they would transmit these foods over and over again.
Well, much how we find the foods today, all the international foods today, how it becomes part of the standard menu in restaurants in New York, whereas, you know, years past, you would have only found them on a menu someplace in Morocco.
Right.
You know, so.
Well, the thing we take for granted, yogurt, mm-hmm. which is an ancient food that predates the Jews. But the Jews play a vital role in changing it. If you asked the average American in 1960 what yogurt was, 95% would say, I haven't the slightest idea.
Right.
Within
right.
10 years, 95% of the Americans were eating it on a regular basis, which is an incredible, if you think about it, an incredible marketing change. And that was basically due to one Jewish family. It was,
and the name of that line was
became Dannon
yogurt, right?
Who totally changed things.
So the cheese. You brought up cheese being associated with a Hanukkah food. Now, was it fried cheese? Now, you said something that I have to hear it from you. The meaning of the word latke.
Yes.
Okay, is, according to your sources.
Little oilies.
Little oilies.
Yes.
Couldn't that also sort of translate into pancake? I mean, I've heard it so much in Ukrainian and everything. Actually means pancake.
Well, latkes enters Yiddish by way of Ukrainian, by way of Italian Latin. Because, again, as I said, these dishes and concepts often flow through Italy.
So they were little oily pancakes.
So the first latkes, per se, or Hanukkah pancakes, mm-hmm. the pre-latkes, were in Italy, and they were basically with cottage cheese fried in olive oil.
Fried cheese, yeah.
It was fried cheese latkes, which actually are delicious.
Yes, they are.
They're sort of like little cheesecakes.
Yeah, my friend Ann Mendelson makes a wonderful sour cream and ricotta-type fried. Well, she just great stuff.
Right. So what happens is that, as you mentioned, the cheese latke originates and the cheese pancake originates in Italy. It then flows into the Ukraine, where it takes – latke is directly from the Italian Latin word for olive oil. But they don't have olive oil in Ukraine and Poland. In fact, they have very little oil, and mm-hmm. it's very expensive.
The fat they have.
The primary oil, the primary oil of Germany and parts of Poland was poppy seed oil, which was expensive and rare. And so
how many seeds does it take?
It takes an awful lot.
Seeds.
But you know, think of like sesame seed oil. It's the same thing. You just keep pounding until you have enough. And so basically, the predominant frying element, particularly in the winter when Hanukkah is falling, is going to be a schmaltz, which is rendered chicken fat.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Jewish dietary laws, you cannot fry cheese. You can't mix meat
with the dairy.
So you can't fry cheese pancakes and schmaltz. And also at that time, in those northern climates, soft cheese is rarer and more expensive. So initially, they shifted to two types of alternate latkes. They continued cheese latkes among certain people.
Mm-hmm.
But the primary latkes for the next several hundred years were two types. One was buckwheat, which had recently mm-hmm. arrived there from the Tartars and Mongols had brought it from Siberia, and basically bellinis. And then the other one was like rye bread. They would take the dough and rye bread dough and kind of make it a little thinner and fry that.
Vegetable. Those were fritters, but a lot of vegetable.
No, you didn't really have any of those. First of all, they didn't eat a lot of vegetables in that area, unfortunately.
Of course, in culinary history, we know that it wasn't a potato latke way back then because potatoes were a New World food and didn't go to Europe until, 1700?
Well, they come very late. The sweet potato. potato came back with Columbus. The white potato did not come until much later.
Yeah.
And when it does show up, it's the Europeans think it's poisonous at best, and it took an act of British Parliament to allow it to be used as animal food. And it's only in the wake of the French Revolution, when you have severe famine in France, that the French begin eating potatoes as part of their diet. And so you're talking relatively late. You're talking at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th
right.
century already.
So when do you, through your research, when did you sort of figure the first... that latkes began to make, potato pancakes came into being.
That's almost easy to show.
Okay.
Because what happens is when the French start doing it, the Germans pick it up, but not the upper class. The upper class and even many middle class Germans thought it was poor man's food and wouldn't touch a potato.
Mm-hmm.
But the masses of Germany began doing it, and they make the first potato pancakes that we know of. It actually showed in Germany. But the Eastern Europeans still won't touch it until in the 1840s, the two severe years of famine in Poland and Ukraine, and all of a sudden they start eating potatoes.
Mm.
And it's that, so we know that the potato latke, the iconic Hanukkah food, only begins relatively very late in Jewish history, which is the 1840s.
And the European Jews really were the first to adapt it to and make it part of their celebration?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes, I mean, first of all, it's cheap. It's something, this is still when food was seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't go to the supermarket and get apples and oranges and stuff that we take for granted today. And the basic thing you had was foods that kept, which
cabbage
was
and potatoes.
And apples.
And apples, right.
Which led to applesauce being one of the predominant accompaniments,
right.
condiments to it. So, again, many traditional holiday foods are based upon seasonal and available items.
It's interesting because we're trying to get back to that seasonal eating today, you know, going back to
right.
the old days. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about the special foods of Hanukkah when we come back after a short break. Stay tuned. A Taste of the Past, and we're talking about traditional Hanukkah foods with Gil Marks, the author of the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food. And Gil, you were talking about how so many things came to be tradition because they were seasonal,
right.
given the things in the cellar. You go to the cellar to see what you can make, and you got some apples, you got some potatoes, right? But what are some of the other traditional Hanukkah foods?
Right. Well,
and seasonal, I guess that would be too.
Another aspect that came along later after the fried foods and cheese was meat foods, because often feasting involved meat. And an interesting aspect of history is that animals are relatively cheap to raise during the summer and early fall when there's plenty of free grass for them to graze on and seeds for them to eat. During the winter, you actually have to pay your own money to provide feed for them.
Mm.
So any animal that wasn't necessary for the procreation of that group was done away with just
butchered
for the winter,
yeah.
which was meant just before Hanukkah. So in Western and Central Europe, a common feast item was the goose, roast goose. And you would slaughter meaning any males, particularly, because most males, except for you only needed one or so, were done away with. And any female passing its child, egg-laying egg or child-bearing egg, so that the you had this surplus of meat all of a sudden that meant it was available and it was cheaper. And they would also, at that point, take the duck fat and render it down and make the schmaltz, and that would provide them with enough frying component, which is vital to survive the winter.
Right.
And but in Eastern Europe, they still had geese, but much less of them. But instead, it was more of a cow society. And so there, you got rid of all of these unnecessary cattle just before Hanukkah time. So there was this surplus of meat. But even at that point, it was still relatively expensive. And they would eat the cheaper cuts, usually, most people, which we would say, like, instead of living high on the hog or low on the hog, it'd be low on the cow.
Right.
And because that's the tougher spots on lower things. And that was the brisket. And stuff. And an interesting thing is that we talked about the transmission and transferal of foods,
right,
is that particularly in America, where the community generally had more wealth and more access to meat, brisket became more, you know, a very important Hanukkah food and amongst the American thing. But culture is not static. And food is not static either,
right,
and it's constantly changing. So Americans would adapt it. They might put onion soup mix in it, cranberry relish.
The onion soup brisket was a very standard recipe throughout the United States.
Cranberry relish when canned.
Who started
pineapple.
That? Lipton or some housewife?
I think, yeah, but yeah. Probably like that, yeah. And then down in Georgia, they would use Coca-Cola brisket.
Mm.
So it's very interesting, this adaptation. And so that's another aspect of the seasonal aspect of how that became that, and how it changes as well. When you have more wealth in America, it becomes more prominent.
Right.
And then the changes and stuff.
Well, tongue was preparation of tongue. Was that also not a standard Hanukkah dish or not?
That was any time dish.
Mm-hmm.
That would be like a celebration dish, maybe a Sabbath. Or particularly if there's a wedding or something like that, then you would do it. But they love tongue.
Well, now we haven't talked about something else, and that's the jelly donut.
Ah, the final one. Now that's an interesting one that has actually an interesting political maneuvering behind it, because basically somebody in Germany created the first jelly donut, and the concepts spread to Poland, where the Poles call it ponchiks, which is
ponchiks,
like rose,
right.
Rosebud.
Yeah.
And actually, a good part of the Australian Jewish community came from Poland. And many of them still refer to jelly donuts as ponchiks.
Mm-hmm. It even transferred to my family, who was not Jewish, but from Poland. And
right.
They called them ponchiks.
Well, the Jews picked it up from the non-Jews in Poland. The Poles basically would make, before Lent, had to get rid of all, you know, various foods they couldn't eat. So they would make ponchiks, which used up the jelly and some of the sugars and breads and butters and stuff like that. So they made jelly donuts. And the Jews kind of picked it up, some, but not all of them. It was a minor custom among certain areas of Poland where they would make, and they filled it either with lekvar, which is prune jam, or rose petal jelly. Which was the cheapest thing that they grew, that could grow in those areas. And basically what happened is in modern Israel, in the beginning of the 20th century, the labor union, known as the Hisadrut, was interested in getting employment for their members. And they figured the potato latke or any kind of latke, anybody can make at home. There's no work, you know, no outside work needed. Now, a jelly donut, first of all, intimidates many people.
Mm-hmm.
I make jelly donuts every year, but not everybody.
Not everybody's an as accomplished chef as you.
But anyway, if you know what you're doing, you can actually do it. But So what they thought, well, you know, for a week, the week before and the week during, we could provide not just people making it, people transporting it, people selling it. There's a lot of jobs involved. And so they kind of pushed that. And so in Israel, the predominant Hanukkah food is the jelly donut, and latkes are kind of minor, and some people don't even make them anymore. And actually, to the point, it's almost like, you know, how Christmas begins earlier and earlier in America, and, you know, like after Thanksgiving, all of New York is already filled with this stuff. Well, in Israel, the jelly donut season gets earlier and earlier, so sometimes a month or two before, they're already selling the sufganiyot, the jelly donuts.
Sufganiyot, right.
And it's And now it's not just jelly donuts, of course. They do dulce de leche, the caramelized fillings, all kind of exotic and interesting fillings go into it. So when I do it, I make a pastry cream and then we take jelly. So we have both of those at the annual Mark's family sufganiyot Hanukkah party.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, what anything else? Some things that came up in either your book or one of the other books, Joan Nathan, certainly, she talks, you know, a lot about the Jewish holiday foods, too. Honey puffs. Are those for Hanukkah or...
That's, you think Teglach is actually...
Or Lukumadis.
Lukumadis is the Greek form of donut.
So that would just be their version of the...
Okay. Right. So each of the different Jewish communities... See, there's not... Many Americans think of Jewish food as just European or Eastern European. Mm-hmm. There's actually a mosaic of Jewish communities that grew up around the world. There's three separate Indian Jewish communities, each developing their own food
That's
and
right.
culture.
Yeah.
Ethiopia, Yemen, all kinds of Jewish communities. And each of them developed their own fried foods for Hanukkah, and usually that's at least one, if not several, sweet treats. And so there's various forms of, like, they're sort of like primitive donuts, rudimentary donuts, mm-hmm. call them that way, in which...
Or the donut holes, just those.
But they also, the key thing that changes the early fried doughs into donuts is the addition of egg yolk. Because the egg yolk makes a firmer batter, and it also helps the dough to resist the absorption of oil. So you get a less oily treat, better treat, and that transforms it. So these early lukmanios, although many add the egg yolks now, in those days they didn't. And the actual authentic ones do not have egg yolks in them. And they're little fly, they're looser dough, so you just drop them in. They're very easy to make. And I make them from time to time, too, because they're delicious.
Oh, interesting.
Nothing beats a hot donut right out of the oil.
Well, I have learned a lot of new things today, and I really recommend this book to people. It's called The Encyclopedia of Jewish Cooking. It starts out with a wonderful timeline. I have to say that I thank you for including that in the beginning of the book, but it is as much a resource as it is a cookbook, too, because you have a lot, like 300 recipes in there.
It's a cookbook, 300 recipes, but it's also a narrative of the Jewish people, because food carries culture and history.
Absolutely.
And each of the little, there's all kinds of entries, everything from bagels and rugelach and common foods that you know of, and more obscure things. There's holiday foods like afikoman, what it really mm-hmm. means for the Passover Seder and things. And so together it tells the story of the Jewish people for the past three millennium.
So that's true. So culinary history is all things wrapped into one. And I thank you so much for sharing with us. It was very interesting.
I thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. I had a great time.
Well, and I thank you, our listeners. Again, this has been A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palaccio, your host. And I'd like to thank our executive producer, Jack Inslee, and our engineer, Nat Wiener.